The theme for the afternoon is non-duality, form and emptiness. Now, how about that for the three nice heavy concepts for a sunny afternoon? I recall in the 70s, that means the 1970s, not in my 70s. traveling around the length and breadth of India there, and having some opportunity, in fact, to meet with a number of much-loved teachers in the non-dual tradition, and or read their writings, and including some of the relatives of Ramana Maharshi there, of Sri Nisargadatta, and of course, to some degree, Krishnamurti, and Vimala Thakkar, all speaking in a very precious and eloquent way. And sometimes, and quite often, in the Advaita, that means the non-dual, sometimes the Buddha is treated and regarded as an Advaita teacher, as a non-dual teacher. I'm not quite convinced. But more importantly, in the tradition of Advaita, one of the essential themes of it, and it has relevance for us here, is, of course, the profound importance of deep experiences, of important realizations. And in the language of Shankara, it is said that Brahman, which means literally means the immeasurable, in fact, and Atman, that means the essential nature of the self, are fused together, are non-dual, are non-different. The useful metaphor for this is the wave and the ocean, that here you and I are as small waves in this great ocean of life, and the common denominator between the wave and the great ocean is water. And therefore water, as the metaphor, is the non-dual of the wave and the ocean. There are precious and valuable experiences, which a number of you have had, possibly are having, or may have, past, present and future here. And these experiences, deep spiritual experiences, mystical experience, can genuinely have a significant and profound and beautiful impact on their life. And some of you may well be able to recall a moment or moments in your life where something significantly happened and shifted, and you can say, well, this time, this period, or this hour, or this place, or whatever, was a real turning point in my life. And human beings have this extraordinary capacity to, in some way, be touched by a circumstance or circumstances of life. It makes a major and important shift upon consciousness, and something of the old has gone, perhaps gone forever. It may be value systems, it may be priorities, it may be states of mind, and one single experience has changed something, has shifted something. And that shift of the consciousness has touched upon something precious there, and out of that, as I say, some new directions or values or priorities take place. Some people, including some of you here, may possibly, before coming to retreats or to meditation or to the inner life, may have had one or more or many of such experiences, and it's brought you here. Others of you may possibly have heard about them, have read about them, perhaps a person has spoken to you about them, and there is a sense that one's potential as a human being, as a condition of consciousness, we might say, that there is so much more to life that can open up, that we can awaken to, and one is looking and meditating and inquiring to see if this is possible. And all of this is part of a precious, beautiful, spiritual, quote-unquote, exploration and tradition. Sometimes in these experiences, they can be so valuable and important for us, and there are many ways in that can happen, of course. Of course it can happen in meditation. Of course it can happen out in the nature. Of course it can happen in close intimacy with another. It can happen spontaneously and quite unexpectedly in all sorts of environments. And of course it can happen with drugs, but I know I shouldn't say that. So there are these ranges and varieties of experiences which take place. They have a benefit, as I just described, important moments and times in our life, but it's also necessary as well to, as always, to be mindful and careful with these kind of experiences. What I have here in mind for these important experiences, how easy, terribly easy, for any important spiritual experience, any shift of consciousness, to kind of grab hold of it and begin then to use it as some kind of reference which one wants to get back to. I remember when I had. Or for some, carrying the idea of a certain kind of experience which one's heard about or read about or thought about and say, ha-ha, my meditation practices, what I'm exploring is somehow to get to that. And that has the big capital T. That wish to repeat, or the wish to get, as two extremes, may really block or cover up or hide the opportunity for, in a way, more important discoveries. And I want to address that a little bit with you. Then just also with the non-dual world, bless it, is... sometimes, and it's in the spiritual circles, this is a, if I may say, a mild health warning here, that there is a certain kind of consciousness which is best described as, well, in English, you probably get it, living in la-la land. I think you probably get a feeling of what I'm saying. And sometimes it is under the name of the non-dual, which is rather tragic. So there can be a kind of false overview. This is in the Buddhist world and there. And in the false overview, there may be some experiences. And in the experiences, conclusions are drawn from an experience, as if the conclusion or the view is the way things are. What I have in mind here, a person may have a deep and important experience of oneness, which is a lovely experience to have. So instead of, as I spoke with you yesterday evening, of self and other and all the difficulties of self and other and the relationships, that there may be a falling away of that duality, self and other, and out of the heart, out of the inner life, emerges a wonderful sense of oneness. Oneness with all beings, even with one's family. And further afield there. So in this condition or in the state of oneness, it is terribly easy to conclude, because it touches us deeply, that's the way things really are. This oneness, this is non-dual, and the experience of oneness is then cherished and held a great deal. In the Dharma teachings, oneness is not ultimate. It's not absolute. It's not the true reality, because the oneness is dependent on something. It's dependent on diversity. Can't have oneness without an idea of diversity, of different things or different people or everything to be at one. One depends on the other. So sometimes we may have experiences of oneness, but sometimes we have experiences of two-ness, three-ness, four-ness, 7 billion-ness, and we have the experience of differences. No, neither oneness nor two-ness, neither oneness nor diversity is worth clinging to as some ultimate reality. There. In the Buddha's Dharma and in the non-dual world, there, forgive my dualities. No, actually, don't forgive them. In the dualities of things, some will say, I think it's a false overview, and sometimes in the name of oneness or in the name of duality, oh, there are differences. There are major differences, and sometimes it's like this, and sometimes it's like that. And we could include in all of that ethics, which are profoundly important. Stephen and Leela and I, of course, make reference to this often enough in the teachings. And some will say, well, yes, there is war and there is peace. There is ripping people off and there is generosity. There is sexual sensitivity and there is abuse. There is being honest and there is lying through one's teeth. There is being calm and clear and there is being drunk. And so some may come from view and say, well, this is the world and none of it is worth grasping onto, could say. And it's non-dual, it's just how things are. This how things are, oh gosh, this how things are. The Buddha is not so sweet. He doesn't take this, oh, the la-la view at all. He's giving a teaching. We are giving a teaching. And that teaching is has a conviction and a willingness to take a point, to stand with that point and to explore it and to recognize that there may be other kinds of views and points there, but in this case of the ethics is stayed too steadily. It's not, oh, there is just this, and then there is just this, and that's how it is. Not in the Buddha Dharma. It's, there is this violence. This violence of the human being needs attention. It's a severely problematic issue. It needs inquiry personally, socially, politically and economically. And it needs to be changed and transformed so that human beings can dig something profound and deep out of each other. That's the Dharma view. It's not just, oh, there is this and there is this. And that applies with the whole theme. That may, for some people, sound, oh, terribly dualistic. All right, why not? Why not? So in the exploration of our... I won't say any more about duality and non-duality for at least 2 minutes. So sometimes when in the exploration, of course, the... inquiry and the investigation also includes here the exploration of form. And in the exploration of form, form for human beings matters immensely, enormously. And when you and I give consideration in this fact to the forms that we are employing here as well as elsewhere, that we form something together. And under the label, this call, in this case, it is called the retreat. We form, one of the good staff said, speak slowly, Christopher. So in the form of the retreat, it's by the agreement, and in the agreement we generate the forms. And of course, there are forms within the forms. And forms mean things for human beings. There's the forms of the meditation. There are the forms of the method and techniques. Stephen just gave a number of the guided forms for the guided meditation, instructions in the morning from Leela. This is the application of forms. And the forms have a very useful purpose in the best way, because they act as a small framework for us as human beings to apply consciousness within the form, making use of the form, the application of the form. But when we come again to the more subtle level of the use of forms, there, we want to be conscious and mindful. What forms in my life do I find easy, I am at home with, and they're not troubling me? What are the forms in my life which I find difficult? And where does that show itself? One of the common ones, which generally will arise in the days here and elsewhere, is particularly with regard to the roles that we have and the form of the roles that we have. Children to parents, and parents to children, and partners and friends and workers and employers and employees. And so here you and I are in this world, and we experience a variety of roles, certain kind of personas which go with our role, and clearly a certain kind of interest and attitude which goes with the role there. And we want to be clear inside of ourselves, what is the relationship to the role? So there is the role, which is our persona, which is our, I like the word in the English, identity. I, or if you're a little slightly Freudian, id, and entity. So we easily make an entity, an identity, of the roles. So sitting here, there is the role of, right now, of Christopher, the Dharma teacher, the servant of the Dharma, the speaker. There's the role, and the role has a form with it. Within the role, or immediately afterwards, I as a human being will have a view about the role. It's not just the event called the speaker, it's the relationship to the event there. And in the role, where am I going to put my trust? Where is the confidence going to go? If it goes to the other, which is you, I love you, but if it goes to you, there, if I lean this way, so the form, even the form of the body, or the form of the mind, or the form of the role, leans that way, I'll be looking towards you for affirmation and approval of what I say. The tone that I say it, if I'm speaking too fast, if I'm speaking too slow, if I'm speaking over here and you can't hear me at the back. So if the leaning of the human being is towards the other for approval, oh my God, be careful, be careful. Because how easy it is when we are looking in the other direction, we are looking for signals, and we might be looking for all kind of signals Sometimes, some situations it's verbal and some situations it's bodily. So if a person is, you know, sitting here and taking, and yawning, or a person keeps looking at their, God, how long is it to go before he's finished there, or gets up and walks out, or decides to do a headstand in the middle of the Dharma talk, it's not quite encouraging. And these things happen. Everything happens in Dharma halls, everything. But anyway. So, the role has a form. With the form of the state of mind, the form in this case of the language, the form of the communication, and we're encouraged to stay as clear and steady in our form, in our posture, in our being, in fact, so that one of the values of the non-dual view here would be the capacity to listen, or the capacity to see, and if there are sometimes comments afterwards, one of my ongoing mantras is born with two ears. One designed evolutionary wise for praise or appreciation, and the other one is for blame and fault finding. And in my case, one ear is considerably larger than the other. That's the fault finding one. So the ability, the willingness, just as the head, the physical head, stay steady between the two ears, I mean, so far anyway, yeah. We also have the capacity to be non-dual, which is to stay steady no matter what we listen to. No matter what we have to hear. And sometimes, as some of you know, you come to the small group. It seems a simple enough task. You sit on the chairs there in the small group, as a number of you did today. You listen to the good voices there. You kindly contribute your experience and your voice. And how terribly easy it is to forget the two ears just for listening in this case, and how easy the form and the language is there, how easily we can seize upon what we hear. So if a person or more than one person, she or he or they, are describing lovely and beautiful experiences, how easy one hears that form of language with the happiness and the love going with it, one hears that, and the other is then used to measure oneself. They are having such wonderful experiences, and my God, my life is a nightmare, etc. They are so developed and advanced, and I'm not going anywhere. So the listening took place, the words were heard, the communications was clear enough, but we've taken a hold of it and used it for comparing. We forgot just to listen. We listen, and the self came in and added something. It added its view of itself to it. We might listen, and sometimes in our listening, a person or persons is describing very difficult process that she or he is going through. And sometimes there is some heartache genuine amongst people of practice, amongst the sharing that takes place. And sometimes, again, we might listen to that, and then that really affects us, it disturbs us, and we feel rather sad, and that people should be going through so much. And once again, we have forgotten that we have listened, we've absorbed, which happens, of course, when we listen. But the outcome of that, it's had some weight upon us, and we feel a bit low, we feel a bit down as a result. And our practice is staying steady in the real midst of life. And an important aspect of our practice is learning to listen, and to listen carefully to see what's there, and to be watchful of comparing, or be watching, or to be watchful of self-pity, or to be watching of taking a hold of it, that our energy kind of drops. We start to feel a bit low because of what we hear. Listening is an extraordinarily important meditation for all of us. In giving attention to the forms that we explore there, that there's the form of the meditator. So there is a process taking place. It has its parallels everywhere else in life. And we might say, in the bare description of the event, there is the meditator, that's you and that's me. There is the meditation, the process, the form, the methodologies, indoors and outdoors. And there is the result of the meditation, the outcome. And this wouldn't be dual, this would be, what would you call it? Trio, no, what would, eh? Three, a three-all. See, rather than non-dual, this would be three-all, rather than dual. Sorry about that, but anyway. So, so there is the meditator, there is the meditation, forms and practices, and there is the result of the meditation. And these three apply in all the other events of life as well. Our welfare, our peace of mind, is all about the meditator, the meditation, and the results of meditation, or whatever other role you define in life. It's about this, it's about the expressions of it, and it's about the outcome. So human beings are very much engaged in these constructions, through the various roles. So this afternoon, we're applying the meditator, the meditation, and the result of meditation. What we sometimes forget is that the result of meditation, I'm just talking about one sitting, one walking period, not talking about lifetimes, but the result of one meditation, meditator thinks that she or he or we is making an objective statement about the outcome of the meditation. So we sit in meditation. Is there any water around before I forgot to bring the... Don't have to go anywhere. It's very nice here. Everybody leaves their water bottles outside. I remember teaching in California, everybody brought their water bottles inside. And I said, I promise you, in the space of 45 minutes or an hour, you will not die of thirst. They never believe me. They always, but here, it's nice. And this is California, of course. Bless them. You should see their five stars. I mustn't go on because we've got to be non-dual, haven't we? But you... I used to smile when I come into the meditation hall. It's a spirit rock, this is, I have in mind here. And there's one person... there was a sign at the back of the hall. This hall, if I remember the number rightly, has enough spaces for 550 meditators. It's a large hall. And one person came, a good friend of mine. This sign was above the door as you walked in, and a friend of mine said, "This hall has space for 550 American meditators and 1,000 Indians." I'm not quite sure if that's a non-dual statement. Thanks, Danny.
Nice.
So there is the construction called the meditator, the meditating, and the result. The worker, the working, and the result. And sometimes we imagine that the result and the viewing of the outcome, that the meditator has a completely independent, objective view of the outcome. So I've completed my meditation practice. I've come to the end of my meditation, my day, my sitting, walking, or whatever. And humanly enough, the view arises about it. And the meditator says, it was like this. As if the meditator absolutely knew, with absolute conviction, this is how it is, or this is how it was there. But the meditator, or the worker in daily life, whatever, the meditator can't be an objective, absolutely independent, detached view of the process. Because it is it. It's up to its neck in it. The meditator, the meditating, and the outcome, the view of the meditation, they are wrapped together like trees and wood. They are wrapped together. And yet we come to the end and sometimes think this is a clear, detached view about. But it's the forms there. But we're not trying to have a clear, detached view about. The Buddha has only one interest. Can I view something? Very simple. It's an incredibly simple, not easy to apply. Very simple statement. Can I view something without any suffering over it? So it's not we're trying to say, I can get the meditator out of the box and in some transcendental way look at what's going on with me and be crystal clear about it and really know what's going on because I'm seeing things as they are. You know, the mantra in the Buddhist world, yawn, yawn. But can I acknowledge that with the box of the meditator, the meditating, and the outcome, that it's all in, as so to speak, in there together. And therefore, the view of the meditator is critical. Could the view of the meditator be more significant than the outcome of my meditation? Sometimes we've got it the other way around. So we might say, I've had a bloody awful meditation or a terrible day, etc. And it's really, I try not to swear, it's really making me feel, what do Buddhists say? Distressed. You know, unhappy or difficult. I really had a terribly, if you're English, terribly rotten day. You know, it's all of those views there. And so the view, there's the result of the meditation, but the view of it is mixed in with it. And the view can make us unhappy. It can generate doubt. It can produce a reaction. It can ask questions. Am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? I've been meditating long enough. I should be much further along the path by now. I'm not getting anywhere. What's the point in doing this? Maybe I'm going backwards. Everybody else seems so clear. Normal meditator's mind. And one has forgotten that the meditator's view of the event is actually more problematic than the event. The view, that is the meditator, has seized upon, identified with it, And then when we seize upon the self of the meditator gets stronger and stronger and stronger there. And then we are carrying from our history, history of past meditations, but not just that, history of other disappointments, history of other views, views of failure, and all of that carries into the consciousness of the meditator. And therefore, we say, the meditator, view of the meditation is more significant than the meditation. It's the view that counts. The view that's the significant. I haven't come to emptiness yet, but hang in. And I appreciate that it isn't easy in the formation, samkara, some of you will know the word, in the formation of the inner life, where the self, that's the I and the me and the my there, it isn't easy in that formation of the samkara with the I and the self to be able to look at something, to be with the process of what is becoming, what is revealing itself, with a rather quiet acknowledgement. And it's not that we're here not to have a judgment. So you come to the end of the meditations or the day, whatever it might be. You have possibly a short summary of how the meditations or the day is. We're very mindful of whether we're putting more into it there. And as I say, sometimes we're not quite clear or sure what is a way to look, that's the view, first link in the Eightfold Path, remember, what is a way to look at a situation so that the way I look at it, it's not problematic. It's not problematic that these human and difficult experiences for us do go on. Life is no picnic. There are issues which arise there, and it's a little skill and work and practice for us to be able to look at any situation in life, and no matter how strong or intense it may be, to be as clear and honest about it as possible, in such a way that the view is the barest description. No more. It's the bare fact. If you have a restless sitting, this was a restless sitting. The bare fact is enough. If you have a calm sitting, this is a calm sitting. If you have a sitting with a lot of thoughts in, this is a sitting with a lot of thought. Sitting where you feel happy and content, this is what it is. So that the view is simply the barest description, which requires minimal use of thought, minimal use of language and description, and just allowing to be with that so that the experience still may continue, but you know your contribution as the meditator, as the seer, as the one who is observing, is in the language of the bare description. And that is a real practice. England just had its, since I've been back there, which has been about 35 years now, it's had just an absolutely lovely. Have you been to England this summer, Stephen? No, you haven't missed anything. And but it had just had a lovely summer there. In England, one wakes up in the morning, it's got nothing to do with the themes, just, you know, ramble. And one is completely surprised that there is blue sky up there. Because sometimes we go so long without any blue sky, there are public debates about what's that blue thing up there above our heads. So each morning we've been waking up to blue skies day after day. It's been just a joy. And I thought, and I used to come, Tovan used to invite me to come in July. They used to go home like toast. And I thought, September, Yom Kippur, September, that's 2 months after July. I worked it out. And God, it's been hot. 33, 34, 30, 35 degrees. And I have this, I'm rambling on, you know, if you get bored, you know, just go to the toilet or something. And I have this skin thing, it's called vitiligo, you see? So if the sun hits the old body, it goes pink, you see, there. And when I show my daughter, who has some body art, which I actually love, I really like seeing a body art, I said, look, this is one up, darling, that's my daughter, on you, because this is body art. See, this vitiligo, it's nature's body art. The skin fades, you get these lovely patterns and white spots. There's not many of us white people left, you know. Anyway, where were we? All right, so sometimes there are the forms. I say these things to... You know, something else to talk about. Dharma gets a bit boring at times. So not for the teacher, for the meditator. So there are the forms that we talked about. And the forms give support to consciousness. But there's something very precious and profoundly important when we recognize the forms, the meditator, meditation, methods and techniques, postures, etc. Appreciate them as well. But sometimes, for the Dharma yogis, the forms themselves, even while being in them, yeah, it's coming to the emptiness now, the forms themselves need to take a kind of lower priority. So initially, for many of us, and at times, the form must take a real priority. You know, I really need to give application to a good sitting posture. That's the form. And some of you, you know, have beautiful postures there, that better than some of the Buddha images. And it's a lovely and precious form. And sometimes with the form of method and technique. At times, and your own experience must confirm this, there is the relationship to the form in which, as I said, the form takes lower priority. And when the form takes lower priority, at times, it can allow the sense of something other. And the Buddha speaks of liberation both ways, and I'll touch upon that in a minute. So, there are the forms which take place. We may feel quite well established. We're just sitting. We're just walking. If we're well established, we can take a genuine and authentic interest in the formless. One expression in the formless is of space. Space doesn't have a form. So we may be sitting, walking, indoors or outdoors, and space, akasha, we can begin to recognize and appreciate space. And it might just be initially the space above our heads, the space around us, the space between the trees, between objects, really have a consciousness of the formless in the expression of space. And that can and go a little bit deeper inside, and at times in our meditation, with or without the presence of method, we can genuinely feel, it's a lovely feeling, of inner space. We really feel spacious within. We don't feel troubled. We do not feel contracted or narrow. We really feel spacious. And it's a really precious human feeling, and it's formless. It doesn't have a form to it. It may be that the formless shows itself in the silence, because silence doesn't have a form either. And sometimes in the meditation hall, when there is a lovely quality, shall we say, the silence is almost palpable. You can almost touch it. There's a certain power in the silence there. And that silence can reach deep into the cells, and it's a genuinely formless experience. You might come in the hall in the middle of the night, or just wake up in the middle of the night, and everywhere it's very, very quiet. There's just the silence, and you can feel the quiet power of the silence. It's very, very, very precious. Another element also, a little more closely with the form here, but is the element of stillness. Stillness doesn't have a shape to it. And sometimes in our meditations, even or with regard to what's going on around, there's just real sense of stillness. And that those periods of the stillness, maybe for a few moments or maybe longer, it's not as if we're trying to control to make a whole sitting very still, but just to feel the complete stillness of things. And the space and the silence and the stillnesses, these are wonderful expressions of something formless there. There are other expressions as well, of course, love and other things, but it's another time. And to recognize the value, this is the non-dual here, recognizing the value and having the wisdom to apply it, the forms and the methods and the techniques there, but also and equally to have the wisdom as well to acknowledge the formless as opposed to the form, some of which is silence and stillness and spaciousness there. But taking it one step further and a little bit deeper with this, because the teachings are an exploration of human beings' relationship to form and formlessness, is in taking it one step deeper, is to look at the whole, you can't look at obviously, but to sense, let us put it like that, what is consciousness? What is consciousness? Or we want to say mindfulness or awareness, that like, what is this? And the significance of this is, like anything else, I can't put consciousness in front of me. It couldn't have a consciousness and then make the consciousness an object. It would be a world of rebounding mirrors, wouldn't it? End up in complete cuckoo land, living like that. So I can't get the consciousness, that means being conscious, in front of me, so to speak, to be able to look at it. But then ask, what is consciousness? And the consciousness cannot be the object. And the objects are clearly defined. Human beings, we have defined what the objects are. There's only half a dozen of them, it's not that much. One is called sights. And the next is called sound that come. And the next is called smell. And each one is a different kind of flavor, we might say, to the previous. And smell. Next one is a touch. Yeah, so sight, sound, smells, tastes, and touch. And the other object which comes to us is the inner life. It is an object of attention. And it's an object of attention, the living proof of it is we talk about it. We talk about what we are seeing and looking at in our inner life. The happiness and the unhappiness and the thoughts and the feelings and the deep meditations and the profound experiences and the painful experiences, they're all objects of the consciousness. But, it's a nice but, it's one of the best. But, That means consciousness cannot be any of that. Consciousness cannot be a sight. It cannot be a sound. It cannot be a smell. It cannot be a taste. It cannot be a touch. It cannot be a thought. It cannot be a feeling. It cannot be a mood. It cannot be a plan or an idea or a state of mind, shallow or deep. It can't be any of that. So it hasn't got a form. Because sights, sounds, smells, tastes and touch have some kind of form to it. So here we are, living in this extraordinary dynamic together, rich in forms, revealed in consciousness, because without consciousness, well, we go to the grave, don't we? So consciousness, the world as we know it, requires the consciousness. It's the only way we can confirm it. And the consciousness confirms what's in the inner life, the forms of our inner life, the forms of our outer life. So consciousness is essentially formless. Not sight, not sound, not smell, not taste, not touch, not feeling, not thought, not state of mind. It's none of that. Could it be? It's a question. It's a loaded question, but it's a question. As a human being, have I got lost in what I look at and have forgotten what has the capacity for the looking? I repeat the question. Have I got lost in what I look at? Sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, feelings and thought. And have forgotten the extraordinary capacity of consciousness to reveal that. I've become bewitched. I've become fascinated. I've become spellbound by all of the forms, inner and outer, and thought, wow, but what's revealing it? This consciousness is revealing it. Here goes the jackpot question. Don't go away. This consciousness, which is revealing this world as I know it, if the world of the forms goes a little quieter, not rejection, not saying they're unreal, not dismissing the world as Maya or anything like that, if the world of the forms go a little quieter in consciousness, could it be that something else is revealed, more profound, significant, awakening than what has been revealed to me so far? That's the jackpot question. The human being's wondrous capacity for exploration, in the best sense of the non-dual tradition, in the language of both the Buddha and the beloved Shankara, says forms have a really significant place in life. Of course they do. Look at us, creatures of form. So many forms in our day-to-day life, in our inner and outer world. The same teachings also say to us, the formless has a profound significance in life. Even the scientists admit that matter constitutes only 4%. The formless, the silences, the stillnesses, the spaciousness, has a really profound place in human, in the nature of things and in human life. But what's precious, to repeat myself, is this consciousness. To be a really conscious human being, to find an agreeable harmony and clarity about oneness and diversity, about self and other, about the extremes, about this and that, to live in tune and in harmony with that, not as an absolute truth, not as the goal of all spiritual practices, but in order that with element of consciousness, discoveries can take place which are extraordinary, precious, revealing, and to use some of those big words of the Buddhists, awakening and enlightening and liberating. And so the consciousness, empty of the forms, its own emptiness of all these forms, and even empty at times of I and my, in its emptiness, much is revealed and everything is possible. Thank you. Enough for today.